welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz over here on the controls.
Yes, different controls.
Yes, different controls, but the result is the same.
Yes, and, well, the show will be a bit different today, but it seems to be like a normal show in terms of... This is the first time we've done something like this.
So. We haven't been in the production studio in a while, but...
Yeah. Anyway.
So for your information, this show is pre-recorded, but...
There you go. We haven't... That hasn't been a state secret.
No.
Anyway, Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live anytime online. Just go to CFRU.ca, and you can click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of the screen. And, of course, you can go to the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean and download the Open Sources podcast and listen to it on whatever device you listen to find podcasts on. Today, as inferred, we will be taking a break from the usual political news because it's Christmas time and it's Christmas Eve. And we're going to be talking about political movies and our favorite political movies, perhaps, or maybe just ones that we admire. We're going to cover a wide spectrum of different themes and plots. So there's contentious elections and difficult issues and feisty politicians and misunderstood motives. All good aspects to base a politically motivated movie on. And it was a bit interesting tackling this experiment, Scotty, because I was looking around at my DVD collection, which is in like three different locations because I have so many. And aside from documentaries, I don't actually have a lot of politically based movies. Like I have maybe a handful. Like I have The American President, the Rob Reiner movie.
Right.
I have Fair Game, which is based on the Valerie Plame, what happened to her. I think I reviewed that once, which is why I have that one. It's not something I probably would have went out and bought myself. And I guess made politically themed-ish movies. Like I have V for Vendetta, which is very politically motivated.
I find that a lot of them I've seen on second-run cinema, like at the Bookshelf.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little plug for the Bookshelf, I guess. But and I missed one that happened this past week, was a doubleheader of some new ones, which was Suffragette and Trumbo, both very politically charged films. Would have been a great doubleheader, but of course, this time of year, it's kind of difficult to make time. But hopefully they will come back. Failing that, it's almost easy, really ridiculously easy now just to get hold of movies. I used to have to like wait and search and hunt for a DVD and usually in the remainder pile because that's the kind of films I watch. or that section in The Beat Goes On that has the, you know, what is it, 10 movies for a dollar or whatever it is, right? But not quite that low. Not quite that low ball. But, I come across them eventually and obviously listen for people's recommendations on stuff. And that's what we're going to do today is give you some recommendations on hot political films that you might enjoy in the new year.
And so how it's going to work is Scotty's going to do one, I'm going to do one, and that's going to repeat after the break.
There'll be banter.
There will be banter, yes. There will be banter. Hard to believe on our show, but yes. So Scotty, your first pick.
My first pick isn't actually a movie. I've deviated a bit, but it's something with a movie feel, and I highly recommend it to everyone. Any talk of politics and media and shows, I always mention Borgen. It inevitably comes up.
Mm-hmm.
It is highly recommended as both a binge watch and just to watch as a show. It's in the can already. It's they're not making any new ones. It's from Denmark. Borgen is actually the parliament buildings in Denmark. It used to be a castle of some kind. I don't know all the details, but Borgen pretty much just means the parliament in the, not the vernacular, but you know, in Danish, I guess. And there's something about this show. It's incredibly compelling right from the get-go, from the first episode. I believe you can watch the first episode online gratis, either on YouTube or whatever, or snippets of it to get an idea of what's going on. And weirdly enough, I actually first heard about it on Coronation Street, believe it or not. They alluded to it, the people sitting around watching it and saying, they didn't mention it by name, but they said, I didn't know the Danish parliament could be that interesting. I'm thinking, what a weird comment. I need to find out more. But it turned out that this show had become so huge that it spread from Denmark to Europe and then on to Canada and the USA by extension. And right now, they're in season 2 on TV Ontario. You can get it online or whatever, like I said at the beginning, all the places where you can get films. There's been a lot of this going on with Danish TV shows, too, in particular police procedural dramas, The Killing, which was remade into a police show for the U.S., and The Bridge, which is a Sweden-Denmark co-production. I didn't think I'd be sitting here talking about Danish TV for the kickoff, but just to give you
an
idea.
But it was also remade
as
an American.
The quality of the stuff is so high that, as is the way in the States, that they remake it because they feel that they do this sort of, we don't think the audience is smart enough kind of thing. You really have to pay attention to Borgen because most of it's in Danish. They occasionally speak in English and other languages, but you got to keep an eye on the subtitles. You absolutely have to pay attention. And I would describe it as riveting. Rotten Tomatoes gives it 100%. I don't think they give much 100%. But this,
I know the first two Toy Stories are also 100%.
Oh,
I just heard somebody say that recently.
I say it's up there with Toy
it's
Story.
It's up there with Toy
Woo!
Story.
So just to give you the premise of the show, which runs through all three seasons, is that Denmark works on coalitions. They never have a straight up government that's one part or the other. They always, by their nature, have to work together. And what happens, and this isn't giving too much away because you probably need to know this, there's a leader of the moderate party. Her name is Birgitte Nyborg, and she is an unlikely person to become prime minister, but she ends up prime minister through a chain of events, which I will not give away because it's so concentrated and in-depth. And the angles to it, it's not just about politics. There's, I would say, 50% of it, or the other aspect is about journalism involved in politics. So it's the perfect show for the Open Sources team and the fans of the show because it covers all of the bases in terms of the crossover between politics and the media and how intertwined they can be, and they usually are. There is a definite link there that can't be severed between people that work in the media and in government, and how the crossover goes on and on over the years when people change allegiances, let's say, or parties and whatnot. And it covers that, but also the events in the wider world. There's an episode where they go to Afghanistan and the political ramifications of that and the journalistic aspects of that, and also anything to do with Denmark in terms of Greenland is still a part of Denmark, sort of. Mm. There's a relationship there. They cover all these international events as real things. Some of them names are changed to kind of
protect the innocent.
I guess they protect the innocent or to avoid liability or whatever. But it's a kind of warts and all portrayal in that it's not just that kind of we're getting the political person. You get this whole behind the scenes too, and I think that's the beauty of it is that I think it was said on NPR in a review of it that because it's also I think it was shown on PBS at some point. That it captures the cost of the personal life to people that are involved in politics and in journalism covering politics and issues like that. It kind of alludes to what Frank Valeriot was saying when he was in.
Yeah.
In terms of there's this whole other thing going on behind the scenes that you don't see in the headlines or whatever as to the costs to your life, your relationships, and all of that. So I can't recommend it highly enough.
Yeah.
You heard about it from me, I guess.
Yeah, you've been talking about it. So this is like the first time you've
been ranting about it for years.
You've been telling our listeners about it, and then
you must watch it.
Yeah, and in my instance, it's just if there's this phenomenon now, peak TV, where there's just so much good TV to watch, and
that's
I have a list of series that I want to check out or people recommend, and that list doesn't get smaller. It just gets bigger, even though I am trying to work my way through different series. Mm-hmm. And then, for every series you complete, two more come up. It's a veritable Hydra condition here. But
well, if you can binge watch Star Wars for 17 hours, I think Borgen would wear it out.
Well,
to
it's 30 episodes,
hours.
Right?
Yeah, so 30 hours.
That's not terrible in terms of binge watching.
You could do 15 in a pause, maybe.
Yeah. It's interesting you should mention all the Danish TV shows getting remade. Well, not all of them, but the significant ones, the high-profile ones. Because this is one I found out in just looking up Borgen online. They've tried already to do a U.S. version of it with Jason Katims and David Hudgens, who are well-known for Friday Night Lights, the series, and for the Parenthood series. So
Is this in the can already, or is it in production?
No. This was I can't remember who they were developing it for, but this was 2011, I think. I think it was shortly after it launched in Denmark and became a hit in Denmark. And I mean, these guys are interesting TV writers. Jason Katims, Friday Night Lights, Parenthood, you know, all the way back to My So-Called Life, and I think he did four on 30 something.
Yep.
So this guy knows his TV, and I guess for whatever reason they couldn't crack it. I mean, he's not a political writer by any means, Jason Katims. He's not like an Aaron Sorkin type. And then, but apparently there is somebody at HBO trying to develop it too. It would be interesting to see what an American version of this would look like, because from the way you describe it, it's very steeped in parliamentary procedure,
mm-hmm.
That the rules according to that world, which are remarkably different from the Republican system, not the Republican Party, but the Republican Republic system in the United States. However, they did do it for House of Cards, smoothly enough, although House of Cards I'm not a huge fan of House of Cards, and I watch enough of it to, you know, sort of see that it's not a political show so much as a show about the Machiavelli, Kevin Spacey, Frank Underwood, look at me being, like, really shifty and
political. Yeah, and you could slot that into any scenario, whether it's mob or whatever, and it's popular. People like it.
Yeah. But, you know, it is... You know, the one place I think maybe they could try and do it, and I wonder if anyone would do it, is make a Canadian version of it. I wonder if, like, the CBC or CTV or anybody would try to do a Canadian version of it.
Yeah, you never know.
That would be really interesting. And it does make me wonder why we don't – like, there was a show in the 60s with Gordon Pinson where he was the MP of somewhere, and I was a –
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember what it was
Quentin
called.
Quentin something. Yeah.
It was Quentin something, MP. But I mean, it's before our time, right?
Yeah.
But
it was your fall asleep show after Hockey Night in Canada, probably.
That sounds about
right. Leafs win the cup. And now
I know about it because his writing was the stand-in for his writing was where I grew up in Georgetown. They shot those portions in Georgetown.
To find it on you, it's probably all on YouTube, right?
Probably. I can't imagine. But there really hasn't been a great political show about Canada's politics, I don't think. And, you know, something like The West Wing, which, you know, when you hear talk about political shows, that's the obvious analogy is The West Wing. It's all sort of meetings in the Oval Office and that kind of statesliness that comes with the American president. But Parliament, and anywhere with a Parliament, works quite differently.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, and it reminded me, it reminds me a little bit of, you know, there's a touch of All the President's Men, but it's also State of Play.
Right.
Which had a UK version
and a
US version, the movie as well. So I think they really, in the States and to some degree in Canada, they underestimate the audiences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you just give it to people without having to try and remake it, I don't know why they insist they do this all the time. They did it with Sanford and Son. You know, there's this whole, we're just going to borrow this idea.
Or Dragon Tattoo. And
yeah, like there's tons of stuff. Like just let it loose to the people and let them decide, right? So,
yeah, and before we wrap up Borgen, I'll just point out that, you know, for anyone who is familiar in the entertainment world of putting together these kinds of lists, it's not a real list unless you cheat. So I know you felt sheepish about, like, I'm going to do a 3-season TV series for one of my entries for political movies, but it's not a real best of list unless you cheat. So that's fine.
Okay. I should put some spin on it right on the top. I'm not going to do a movie. I'm going to do a TV show.
Yeah.
But it's the best TV show.
But yeah, and like I said, it's on my list. And because it's subtitled, it's not something I can put on in the background.
No,
and,
definitely
and,
not.
As I'm doing other things, and which is usually how I watch a lot of things.
I got to tell you, there was an episode that made me cry, and that never happens. Mm-hmm. That'll tell you how powerful this stuff is. So
they should put that on the DVD box that made Scotty
made Hertz cry.
Yeah.
Bozo makes people laugh, but Borgen makes me cry. Anyway, on that note.
Well, here's a movie that won't make you cry. Anyway, my first pick, which is Head of State. It's a 2004 movie, which was co-written, co-produced, directed, and starring Chris Rock, popular comedian.
Yeah.
And
Sorry.
No.
I'm excited by this pick. I'm like, yes.
Well, Chris Rock... you know, he's more political than perhaps people realize, and this certainly reflects that. And it was made in 2004, like I said. So it's about a Washington, D.C. alderman who's kind of down on his luck. He's like a man of the people. So there's a scene early in the movie where he's talking to another city councilor who was played by Keith David. Yes.
Oh, and not David Keith.
No.
Sorry, that's
that's one of those weird
the running joke.
Yeah. And he's telling him, like, you got to play by the rules. You got to wear a suit and you got to, you know, you got to play ball. And this is after Chris Rock's character, Maze Gilliam, rescues an old woman and her cat from a building that's about to be demolished. So he becomes sort of like a local hero. Meanwhile, one of the candidates for president, it's never made clear. We watched the movie and it's never made clear whether the party he ends up running for president for, Maze Gilliam, is Democrat or Republican. I imagine it's Democrat, but some of the machinations make you think of the Republican. Anyway, Maze Gilliam ends up becoming the candidate for president 10 weeks before the election, when the presidential and the vice presidential pick end up dying in a plane crash. Yeah, it sounds bad.
My eyebrows just went up like, what?
it's kind of written off as like a joke in the movie too. But so Maze Gilliam becomes a candidate for president, and he's kind of chosen because it's 10 weeks till election day. The incumbent pick, I guess, is the current vice president who's running for office, and it's fairly certain he's going to win. But they think, you know, we'll appoint this, you know, heroic, local, feisty black man as our presidential candidate, and it's going to make us look awesome because we just made a black man a candidate for president.
A bit of foreshadowing there.
A bit of foreshadowing, because it was just 4 years later, right? And so it'll make the party look good, and then go into 2008, and the guy who sets him up, Maze Gilliam up, played by James Rehorn, wants to be the candidate in 4 years. And so what ends up happening, of course, is Maze Gilliam realizes that he's a bit of a party patsy and starts to reorganize himself to run as his own character, which starts making him exceedingly popular. And there's, you know, hiccups along the way, of course. But what I find interesting about this movie, it's like silly in places, right? It's, you know, there's...
It has to be Chris Rock. Like, there's no way...
It's like openly silly. You know, it's not like really smart political comedy all the way through. Like, there's this... there's a Robin Givens is in it, and she plays Chris Rock's former fiance who dumps him like right before he becomes president. But she dumps him because, like, you're never going to make anything yourself, and you're the city alderman for the down and out ward. Like, you have no interest in, you know,
is this whole subline about him trying to get her back? Is that
no?
Oh, there isn't.
He's not trying to get her back at all. She tries to get him back.
Ah, right.
And, like, she's always popping up at these rallies and all these events that he does, and it inevitably ends with him yelling for his security, who takes her away. But I guess they just, like, leave her somewhere because she always inevitably comes back and tries again, right up to election day.
A bit like a stalker, kind of.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I mean, that's kind of silly. There's an entire character who is like the campaign prostitute, played by Stephanie March. And I guess Stephanie March, who you may know from, she was the long running DA from Law and Order Special Victims Unit.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, I guess it goes back to like when sex scandals were a thing, where it's like, yeah, we got sick of sex scandals, so now we have our own campaign prostitute. And I mean, that's kind of silly. But the thing I find interesting about it is not just the fact that this was 4 years before Obama, you know, was elected.
And of course, his campaign went exactly like that, right? That's me.
Just about, yeah. But no, it's sort of. There's always been this piece in the back of my head that I've always wanted to write about. If you haven't liked the way Barack Obama has been president, blame Chris Rock and blame it on head of state, because the key scene, which is like kind of the end of the first act, is after he's been through all these speeches where he's been reading caged comments and you know, all this stuff that's been, you know, focus grouped to death, is that he comes out and he gives his own stump speech, where he says, like, how many of you are broke? And you can find it on YouTube. But he says, like, how many of you are broke? How many of you make just enough money at the end of the week to be broke? And it starts appealing to people. And what's interesting now looking at this movie is what's going on in the United States with the Republican side, with the rise of the outsider candidate, mm-hmm. right? And it's – I'm not saying that Chris Rock is – his character is analogous to Trump or Carson or any of these guys. But – just the appeal of someone who's not part of the machine, who comes in and upsets the machine. And it's almost like a very folk hero-y trope now in American politics. That's reflected in this movie and in real life, too.
Yeah, we've seen examples like that in the past, like, say, Ross Perot or Ralph Nader, or even Bernie Sanders to some degree now, in that there's this whole kind of people really like it, whether they will elect that person or not. Always remains to be, well, of course they don't generally, But it really appeals to people, not only just in film and media, but you know, in real life too. There is that whole underdog thing. It's I think it's a plot line possibly in every every American movie generally.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's
every
well,
movie,
most American
maybe.
Movies are about a lot of like it's practically academic. Like, how many American movies are about an outsider who comes in and upsets the established order? Whether that's, you know, something like The Natural or even Star Wars, Luke, the ultimate outsider, raised on a planet at the back end of space, comes in and defeats the evil empire, or helps lead to the defeat of the evil empire. So, I mean, that's certainly part of it too. The flip side of it is the character who's the vice president, played by Nick Searcy, who people may know from being Raylan Givens' boss from Justify. I think that's probably his most. He's one of those actors who, like, I recognize that guy.
He's
that guy from The Thing. But his character, who's Vice President Brian Lewis, always ends his speeches with "God bless America and nowhere else," which is, I mean, it sounds so cartoony, but you know, when you're watching something like the Republican debate the other night,
it's implied, right?
Yeah. Well, exactly. God bless America and nowhere else, and you know, talk about canned speeches. Like, he's, you know, the only things you really know about him by the end of the movie are he's been vice president for 8 years, he's a war hero, and he's Sharon Stone's cousin. And it's kind of repeated ad nauseum.
Does she have a cameo?
No, but okay. There is a scene where the news broadcaster says that she throws her sport behind Maze Gilliam. But
they make a basic instant joke.
Yeah, so, you know, as Sharon Stone goes, as does the country. But of course. But there's, I mean, it does really, that simplicity that, you know, you can sum up this person in three lines, it seems to be something else. You know, the Ben Carson, neurosurgeon, Seventh-day Adventist, you know.
Incredibly mellow guy.
Incredibly mellow. Donald Trump, bombastic, you know, real estate mogul.
Wealthy.
Yeah, wealthy, classy. But, you know, it just
And
seems,
then there's everybody else. Right?
Right. But there's also an expectation from people, too, that we can pigeonhole you. And, you know, you if you identify as a Republican, you can't be for doing something about climate change. You can't be for you know, dealing with immigration and reforming immigration. You can't work with the Democratic president. There's all these litmus tests. And you know, yeah, you can say, look at the movie and say that the Searcy character, Brian Lewis, is like this empty shell of a person. But that's almost what some people in the United States want. It's like just an empty carcass that you can just fill with your own political needs and wants and ambitions on.
That's interesting that you say that they don't actually specify what party he belongs
to,
which is indicative of what, you know, how politics in general. It's kind of like those movies, like, you just have the president, like Independence Day or whatever. It's like, there's the president. And they actually say, is he or she Republican or Democrat? They're just kind of there. It's like, they're the president. And that's the respect, I guess, they have for that position. Because even people that dislike Obama, there'll be a point in the future. And we see it now with Jimmy Carter. You know, no one will say anything bad about him. And he just sort of exists in this on this pedestal. It didn't really matter that he was a Democrat or Republican. It's like, well, he was the president, so that was like the ultimate cool points.
Nixon, too, to a certain extent.
Yeah.
I mean, they still had the full court press funeral for Nixon, even though he left the office in basically disgrace. And a lot of people were still ticked off years later that Ford pardoned him. But, I mean, that is the interesting thing. It's like, this is it's not a highly political movie. And like I said, there's a lot of silliness in it. Like, you know, there's a Tracy Morgan character who's like one of the people from his neighborhood who like steals meat and resells it. And, there's the silliness in it, but yeah, that's the stark thing I found. It's interesting that they never identify political parties. I mean, it's kind of inferred that Maze Gilliam is running as a Democrat, but there's nothing that says he's a Democrat, and there's nothing that says that Brian Lewis is a Republican. It's there's something about a purity of the commentary on politics, because I think as soon as you make something partisan like that, people start obviously lining up on sides, and that is an interesting observation, because if you think about the American presidents, obviously he's a Democrat because that plays into the theme. He's about to run for re-election. Or on the West Wing, where the president's a Democrat because that's where you build the conflict is, mm-hmm. the party politics. But yeah, Independence Day. I don't know if Bill Pullman's a Republican or Democrat, or 2012, which is another Roland Emmerich disaster film. I don't know if
is it Bruce Greenwood? He's president.
I think he was in one of the National Treasure movies, actually.
Yeah.
But in 2012, it was Danny Glover, I think. Anyway, you don't know what party he is. The closest thing in one of these like huge disaster movies where you learn the president, where you think you know the president's party, I think it's like The Day After Tomorrow, where where Kenneth Walsh plays the vice president, who's so clearly modeled after Dick Cheney.
It's so funny
he looks like Cheney.
Canadians to play the president.
That's true too, like actually.
Gordon Pinson in that. What was that old computer film? It's of the same vintage of Quentin, whatever MP. Corbin. I want to say the Corbinite maneuver, but then no.
That's a Star Trek episode,
I think. Corbin Project.
We'll have to look up.
It's got Victor from the YNR in it as well, so who did a lot of movies,
yes,
including Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
We're just going to do a movie show from now on, a political show. Forget it. We're just going to talk movies all the time.
Anyway, Head of State, I'm sure you can. I'm not sure if it's on Netflix or not, but it's probably super easy to find at Thomas Video or wherever you get movies from.
Sounds great.
Yeah, so it's worth checking out. It's on 90 minutes, easy breezy to sit through. And if you like Chris Rock, I think there's a lot to recommend it to, and he's a pretty sharp guy. Anyway, we're going to take a break here for our usual music and PSAs, just because it is Christmas Eve. It doesn't mean we can't get away with not taking breaks and playing people's commercials and things.
We need a break.
Yeah, we need a break. Anyway, we will be right back with more Open Source's political movie special right here on CFRU 93.3 FM. And welcome back to the Open Source's favorite political movies show. And just before we get into the next picks, I just wanted to say for the record, the name of the show is Quentin Durgin's MP, starring Gordon Pinsent
and Leslie Berringer.
Well, it's IMDb, actually. Ran for 5 seasons, 1966 to 71. Well,
that's a long...
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm surprised it's not on DVD or something somewhere.
I'm sure, well, some old stuff like that somehow gets uploaded to YouTube. I mean, but there's been a lot of discussion about...
It was CBC, obviously it was CBC, right?
Yeah. But there's been a lot of discussion and, you know, most of it involves, I guess, Doctor Who, because a lot of the Doctor Whos have been lost because they just taped over.
And it's always a big deal when they find one, right? There's a radio station in Nigeria or a TV station somewhere that has a full...
Yeah, they found like 21 tapes of Doctor Who somewhere recently, and it was very exciting because it was like some of the earliest missing Who that... Anyway.
I must say one of them was very good. I got a loan of one. So I'm not quite a Whovian, but I do watch it. So.
But this isn't the Doctor Who appreciation show.
No, that's right.
It's back to political movies.
Back to business.
So Scotty, your second pick.
My second pick is actually a movie. I think back in the Beyond the Ballot Box days, I was always picking a Ken Loach film, and I'm going to stick with tradition and do that again because he's possibly my favorite in terms of political films. Mm-hmm. There's a film called Land and Freedom. It's actually about 20 years old. I think it came out in 1995. And it covers an interesting period in history, the Spanish Civil War, in that there were a lot of people, including in Canada, that decided they wanted to go and fight the fascist government of Franco in Spain. There was this people would travel around and try and whip up support. I should also mention the history aspect of it, too, and mm-hmm. that there were a lot of more people that leaned more towards socialist, communist, openly beliefs in the 30s, just because things were so bad and the Soviet Union was still a new kind of concept. That's not just to say that people that were sympathizers of communism or the Soviet Union went. There were quite large anarchists.
How bad Stalin was hadn't quite made the rounds.
No,
yet.
That's right. But it almost becomes clear that this is sort of an aside during the Spanish Civil War how bad Stalin was. But that's we'll talk about that another day maybe. Anyway, the film follows a man named David who is an unemployed. He's from Liverpool actually, and he's also a card-carrying communist. And volunteers to go and fight in Spain. The whole thing is presented in flashback in that he's, by the time, I think it's supposed to be in real time, so it's probably about 1995, the granddaughter who is, I guess, his caregiver goes to his flat and finds out that something's happened to him. So through this, we find out, through his period of time in the hospital, the daughter goes through his stuff and has no idea that he was involved with this. I had at least a couple of veterans in my family, not of the Spanish Civil War, but of World War II, and they just didn't talk about it. I think it's a very British thing. Mm-hmm. Unless pressed, they won't tell their story, but she's able to piece it together from the stuff that's lying around in the shoebox and whatnot. So Ken Loach, you probably heard the name if you listen to Beyond the Ballot Box. No, if you... he's a fairly well-known director. The film that you might know off the top of your head was The Wind That Shakes the Barley.
Which got a pretty wide release.
Yes, starring Cillian Murphy, old Blue Eyes, who's also in Peaky Blinders now.
Yeah.
You know this guy. He's one of those guys who say, oh, yeah, I know him.
He was Scarecrow in Batman Begins.
Ah, there you go. That's right.
And 28 Days Later.
See, if Adam wasn't here, I'd be like...
All these random little things.
He was in 18 films. We don't know anything. But Ken Loach tends to get hold of people just on the cusp of stardom. Robert Carlyle, when he was a young fellow, was in a couple of Ken Loach movies. I'm thinking in particular Riff Raff, which is another, it's called a working class movie. So these types of films are known, at least in the UK, as kitchen sink dramas, of which, and this is the second time I'm probably going to mention Coronation Street, the ultimate kitchen sink drama that has been long lived was Coronation Street. Obviously, it's a little bit different now than it was back in the day, but you could probably visualize what I'm talking about just by picturing that whole kind of fly in the wall of a working class home. That's how Ken Loach works. In fact, when he was directing films, he just kind of does this, steps back and lets it all happen. He uses a lot of non-actors in his movies, and it works somehow. There are times when you see non-actors in films, like people doing cameos and that, you think, man, they're really terrible. Who is that? And it's like, oh, it's so-and-so. Ivanka Trump. I don't know. Pick somebody who doesn't really act but ends up doing a cameo in something. With Loach, it tends to work. Somehow, I think there are certain films that he does, not necessarily this one because it was a period piece, but he's done a few on working people, in particular Bread and Roses, which had, oh my God, I've lost his name. It'll come to me eventually. Where that film was from, I think the year 2000, and it was about cleaners in the United States and the attempts to organize them, and he used the actual cleaners in the film, so that's how he rolls. Still going. He's about 80 years old. I should mention that the lead in Land and Freedom was Ian Hart, who was he? I think he's played John Lennon probably more than once, and he was. I'm going to blow with the name.
Adrian Brody was in Bread and Roses.
Adrian Brody, Quinarius Quirrell from I think it was Harry Potter 2, Philosopher's Stone. That's how you'd know Ian Hart if you saw him.
Philosopher's Stone was part one.
Philosopher's Stone was part one. See there, I have seen all the Harry Potter movies. I don't know what the hell, which one's which, but I know he was the Muggle Studies professor. There you go.
Wasn't he the Dark Arts professor in part one?
Maybe he had both gigs. I don't know.
All right.
I don't know.
Talk about Land and Freedom.
Talk about Land and Freedom. So, yikes. There's a lot of Land and Freedom kind of reflects a little bit what's going on today in Syria, and that the Spanish Civil War was a multi-party conflict, and there were all sorts of small little militias with sort of heading towards the same aim, which was getting rid of Franco's fascists, Franco being backed by the Germans and the Italians eventually. But the smaller groups who all leaned left, the anarchists, there was multiple divisions among the communists. Mm-hmm. And part of what happens with Ian Hart's character, David, is he ends up in the middle of that conflict as well as the greater conflict. So he is a communist leftist, goes to fight fascism for what he thinks the right reasons. But of course, it's like anything, your idealism just goes straight down the toilet when you get there because of all of the other stuff that's going on, things that are completely out of your control.
Mm-hmm.
You think you're doing the right thing, but in actual fact, and we see it with these, a lot of people now, including some Canadians who have gone to fight with the Kurds in Syria. So there's a massive parallel to this. It's been drawn by more than one people, not specifically this film, but these conflicts. So I don't know. There's just something about this type of film that appeals to me, not just because it's Ken Loach. I remember when I was very young, and again, it was TV Ontario. TV Ontario has come up again, too. They tended to just sort of pick up British dramas and play them. I guess, I don't know if it's because they were able to do it cheaply or that was just how it worked, or they figured that it was quality stuff, and it is. There's Ken Loach's first wide-release film was a film called Kes, about a boy that adopted a bird. And I know that sounds almost completely ridiculous, but it was something that my mother, who's also a Coronation Street fan, really liked. And I ended up watching with her. I was like, this is really interesting. I tried watching it again not that long ago, and it was a bit lumbering. But I think there was a point in time where films were kind of lumbering. You know, it was like you're trying to give this message, and it was supposed to be in real time. So it's not like an Andy Warhol film where they're watching somebody sleep for 8 hours. What film was, I don't know. that is unwatchable, but maybe there's a super edit of these films somewhere. But like I said, Land of Freedom, completely watchable from start to finish without a super edit. And I can't say enough about Ken Loach.
And
I'm going to start a fan club.
You don't think there's already one in existence?
I don't know. I tried to get him on the show, my old show, but it was a year of back and forth with his person. And it was like, Mr. Loach is kind of busy. And,
yeah, he's still cranking them out.
Yeah,
I mean,
for an 80-year-old guy, he's cranking it out.
And,
so,
there's a lot of old directors who, like, they just keep working until they drop. Robert Altman was like that. Robert Altman was still cranking out films when...
Not to diminish the abilities of 80-year-olds,
but,
I mean, it's the body of work is huge. I mean, he started in TV, and now it's films and whatever. It's unbelievable.
And he has he's had difficulties given the subject matter he's... tackled.
Mm-hmm. Like not without controversy in lots of cases. He's very anti-Zionist Israel, and anytime there's a film festival, he'll be like, oh, you can't show that film, and gets into trouble quite regularly
regular at Cannes. I mean, I think this was an award winner at Cannes, if I'm not mistaken, or at least very much in contention.
Yeah, he's always up for the Palme d'Or, one of the awards there. He'll never ever be up for an Oscar. Although maybe when the Shakes the Barley was, and I'm not even sure why that ended up in such wide release, because a lot of his films are just you need to hunt for them. Like I was saying earlier about the, the Delete Bin of the Beat Goes On. But Thomas Video used to have all of them, and some of them were on a video cassette. So I guess they're probably not as available now at Thomas Video. But it's like anything; you can dial it up online. I believe he has his own YouTube channel. And if you want to watch any of these, including Land and Freedom, if you want to shell out $3, go for it. So, by any means.
And the Spanish Civil War, too, not something that gets a lot of attention on film, or at least North American film, I guess, because there was no skin in the game over here.
No. But although, like, 1,500 people from Canada went, and they weren't supposed to. That would make an excellent film.
Yeah.
As to why, what they were driven by, and I believe the last survivor has died recently, because I mean it obviously predates World War II by a few years. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a monument to it at Queen's Park, and that is a story in itself as to how this rock from the fields of Spain ended up at Queen's Park. I don't think, considering the times now, I don't think it would be allowed, because they weren't supposed to go. They were prohibited by the government. Not unlike they consider some of the Kurdish groups, terrorist groups in this country, or at least they did, and in other countries, and you're really not supposed to go. And of course, when you come back, you'll be in—I wouldn't say trouble, but there'll definitely be a red flag on your account when you come back to Canada. It's like, so why were you fighting with these terrorists back in those days? I think, and because it was all sort of, subsumed by World War II.
Yeah.
But I believe a lot of the veterans of it weren't allowed to fight in the war. So maybe that's a screenplay we could write. I don't know.
We'll add it to the...
We probably should.
We'll add it to the workload.
Yeah, exactly. I can't even read a paper. It's no time.
But, you did make an interesting point about drawing the analogies to what's going on today within Syria. Because, if you don't know anything about the Spanish Civil War, like, try reading the Wikipedia page on the Spanish Civil War, because you have to click on all the links so you can get ahead on all the, so you get your head around all the various players, because it wasn't just one communist group. There were foreign communist fighters. There were local Spanish communist fighters, and then there were various degrees of, severity and communist belief. There were the people who you talk about who, like, it was the Great Depression, and, for worker rights and making it the capitalist system a little decentralized was appealing, just as an idea, because you're hosed, you can't find work, you're living on bread and water like a prisoner, and there's got to be someone to blame for that, and it's why not the money guys that crashed the market. And then you have the really hardcore Bolsheviks, or the people believe in the core tenets who live and breathe Marx, and then all points in between across the spectrum. It was like a really interesting time.
And then they all start fighting with each other, which probably ended it all.
And
that's happening now, right?
But there's a plot in this, right, where the main character David he ends up with the government fighters. And then he goes back to his original brigade, who are all foreigners, and there's kind of a clash there. So even amongst the side that's fighting for the government, because the other side is of course the fascists, and so they're kind of the bad guys, in quote marks, because they're the fascists. So even amongst the quote unquote good guys, you had these tremendous differences that resulted in violence between them.
It's one of the best or most telling scenes in the movie when they do start taking shots at each other. I believe it's in Madrid, which was sort of the retreat point of the government when Franco's troops were marching on. So, and eventually, it wasn't a very long conflict, but of course then World War II came along and that changed everything once again. But there were a lot of people then that felt that this fight would have sort of stopped fascism in its tracks. Which again is a very idealistic approach to it, and obviously didn't at that time, and look what happened.
Well, if Franco wins, and then World War II pretty much starts.
Mm-hmm.
You can almost see it as
it was like the test run.
Yeah, or it's like, well,
and hopefully that's not the case with Syria, but
hopefully not.
No,
but although my next pick, there's definitely some pretty strong analogies. It's W. Which is Oliver Stone's biographical drama about the life of George W. Bush. And it came out in October 2008. So it came out right before the 2008 election. Of course, George W. Bush wasn't running in that election. And by then, his approval numbers were south of
the toilet.
Yeah. So let's call it south of the toilet.
South of the toilet. A screenplay by Adam A. Donaldson.
Yeah. South of the toilet. Coming in 2017. Anyway. I don't think this was, Fahrenheit 9/11, the Michael Moore documentary came out in June 2004, which was obviously designed to try and change minds about George W. Bush. And I think Oliver Stone had kind of a similar idea, but by then no one's mind really needed changed about the legacy of George W. Bush. Except what I will say about W is it makes George W. Bush very sympathetic.
Really?
Yeah.
I have to admit I haven't seen it yet, but
yeah, it's,
I remember it coming out and I was like, yeah, that's on my list, but
yeah, it's Josh Brolin plays George W. Bush, and it flashes back between his days.
That's an interesting pick for Bush. Sorry, I just...
Yeah, no, he...
I always picture Will Ferrell when I think of somebody playing George Bush, right? But and that's probably not fair either, but...
Well, it was the same thing when they got Julianne Moore to be Sarah Palin for the HBO movie Game Change.
Ah, right.
Because who do you think of when you think of somebody playing Sarah Palin? You think of TSA.
I thought of that before she even played her. I was like, yeah, she has to come back and do this. And then it happened.
Yeah, but like Julianne Moore, who really kind of captured Sarah Palin without it becoming a caricature. I think Josh Brolin really captures George W. Bush without it being a caricature. There's scenes where he's leading cabinet meetings, where he's doing all the gestures and the way the George Bush carried himself with that Texas swagger, calling people out by their nicknames. It was like, what do you think, Vice? He says to Cheney, and they're like Guru for Condoleezza Rice, and Genius for Karl Rove, who's played by Toby Jones. Very good by Toby Jones, too. He makes Karl Rove somewhat human. But yeah.
You wouldn't think it possible, but...
but yeah, it, so it really makes George W. Bush sympathetic because it goes back and forth between the lead up to the Iraq War and George Bush's life in college when he was at Yale as a drunken screw up, to his time in the oil fields as a drunken screw up, to his time as running for state seat as a drunken screw up, and what it really pushes here is the idea that this is a man who was living in the shadow of not just his father, who was a war hero, congressman, head of the CIA, vice president, president, like the resume of a lifetime kind of thing, but the fact that his older brother, Jeb Bush, was kind of the heir apparent, and there's
now he's got 3% or whatever it is.
Well, this is the thing. There's a scene near the end where George Bush is. It's after the Iraq War has been fought and quote unquote won. It's after he does the mission accomplished thing where he's having this dream where he walks into the Oval Office and his father is there, and his father starts berating him for being for all the things the film has been alluding to about him being a screw up and having no direction, and how and there's a scene where George H.W. Bush, played by James Cromwell, says, "You have ruined it for Jeb."
Ooh.
And there's been this whole back and forth the whole movie because in the 90s, of course, George W. Bush decides he's going to run for governor of Texas. At the same time, Jeb Bush has decided he's going to run for governor of Florida. And he's there with his father and his mother, and he's like saying, "I'm going to run for governor of Texas." And their first reaction is, "Well, Jeb's running for governor of Florida. Is that really fair to Jeb that you're going to run for governor of Texas while he's running for governor of Florida?" And, like, for George W. Bush, it's a great moment. You know, he's like, I have another one of these moments where he's like, "I have this direction. I have this idea. I'm going to do great." And he's, like, he's really excited. And he's explaining to his father, and like, "Well, what about Jeb? You're kind of screwing Jeb over." And he's like, "Forget about Jeb. Like, I want to do this. I feel strongly and passionately about doing this." And you can't help but feel sorry for him. And I wonder how much of this is, like, actually true. I don't...
Well, that's the thing with Stone. I mean, if you think back to something like JFK, there was a lot of implied. There's truth in it for sure. So that's what I'm wondering about W. Is it based mostly on fact? I mean, obviously a lot of it is speculative.
Sure.
But I guess the storyline in terms of the way it evolved is generally true.
Yeah.
Or there would have been a lawsuit probably, right?
But I mean, it's no secret that Jeb has always been the quote-unquote smarter Bush, the Bush who's had, like, direction and building his life up.
Shades of the Fords a little bit, eh?
Yeah, like, it's a little
Fords
bit.
Are like budget Bushes, aren't they, really?
Yeah, a bit. But, I mean, there is that parallel. I mean, Doug is obviously the smarter
the
one.
The
one who has,
operation.
Like, some kind of drive and mm-hmm. ambition, whereas, you know, Rob is kind of like, "I'm just going to lay back here and, you know, I'm going to answer phone calls. I'm going to connect with people and do the handshake thing."
But he really is driven, really wants to do it, even if he's not necessarily the contender.
Right.
Look what happened. Mayor of Toronto.
Yeah, and it's kind
of... Look what happened. President of the U.S. There you go.
And yeah...
The unlikely president of the U.S.
I mean, I think a lot of the stuff going on with Jeb right now is Jeb's fault. Or not... Is just like he doesn't have what his brother had, like they'll sit down and have a beer with, and it's not all to do with Trump. I mean, yeah, you can come in and say Trump's sucking all the oxygen out of the room, but it's also Jeb's problem that he just can't connect, and it's kind of the thing, like, well, why do you want to be president? Well,
because
my brother
just
was president,
because,
my father was president, and I don't think that's really been articulated well by his campaign.
Hmm.
But getting back to the movie, because that's what we're here about. It is funny how Oliver Stone can kind of take these figures who really should be unlikable in the historical context, because there's another presidential movie that Oliver Stone did, Nixon.
Oh, yeah.
He did Nixon with Anthony Hopkins as Nixon.
Mm-hmm.
And he does a really interesting job of – because when Nixon came out in like 95. It's like right around the time Nixon died.
Mm-hmm.
And as we said in the previous, like, there's still the pomp and circumstance you get as the funeral for an ex-president. But at the time, a lot of people were saying, well, why are we giving this man pomp and circumstance? You know, he,
mm-hmm.
you know, Watergate primarily, but, you know, also prolonging Vietnam ad infinitum.
But it's the old, well, it's just what we do. So
right. And what Stone does with Nixon is, you know, present a man who is extremely ambitious but gets caught up in a machine that is even more more ambitious, but like more powerful than even the president of the United States is. And there's a scene where you can watch in the director's cut. It's not in the theatrical cut, but it's a scene with Hest, the head of the CIA, where it's like it's kind of like this weird, like supernatural seance scene. It's where his eyes go black. The head of the CIA's eyes go black, and it's like the beast is revealed. And
sounds like Stone takes it there. Yeah.
And you know, the beast being like kind of like a conflagration of like conspiracy theory stuff about the late 20th century and the military-industrial complex. But it's just like this beast in the heart of America that even Nixon, who was like the Machiavelli president of all Machiavelli presidents, can defeat. And in W, it's really kind of a story of a man who has great ambition and wants to prove to his father that he is not a drunken screw-up in the midst of creating – I mean, he wasn't drunk at the time, but in the midst of allowing himself to craft one of the – what – I mean, we're still probably too close to it, but in 50 years, it will probably be looked at as one of the greatest foreign policy screw-ups in the history of the United States, and that's going into Iraq.
Oh, absolutely.
And
yeah.
Where there were no WMDs and where the post-war wasn't handled very well. And there's a scene where W realizes just how out of hand the situation's become, where he's having a meeting at CENTCOM and he's like, who's in charge of trying to find the WMDs? And it's like everybody around the table, and it's like it's Colin Powell and Condi Rice and Tommy Franks, and they're just like, well, it's so-and-so's. No, it's so-and-so. No, it's so-and-so. It's this person's job. Like, no, it's the undersecretary of this at the State Department that's supposed to be doing it. And, of course, that person's not even in the room.
High-order deflection.
And, you know, Bush is just – he's completely broken. He's completely frazzled because he's dependent on these people to give him advice to sort of mold his – you know, the direction of this is, and they have completely come up short. And, you know, it speaks to the need, I guess, when you are the commander in chief to sort of know yourself and not depend, you know, like you depend on advice of others, but you can't sort of craft where you're going in terms of your policy ideas just by purely on letting people lead you to where you need to go. Like, if you know what you want to do, you have to know in your heart the reasons why you want to do something. So in that regard, Bush is at fault. But, I mean, it's still an incredibly sympathetic portrayal.
So that sounds great. Is it Stone length? You know, the Stone tends to go into the 2 to 3 hour range.
No, it's 2 hours long.
Not that I wouldn't watch it because it was long. It's just sometimes
it's
seems
not.
To be, he does, like, epic films, and you're like, oh, my God.
Well, huh. Yeah, he's, like, re-edited
Could
Alexander.
You not have edited that? Oh.
Like, 3 times, and it gets longer every time.
Oh,
but no,
longer? Does it get shorter, please?
No. Oliver Stone only adds longer. I have the JFK,
8 hour JFK
VHS, and it's like 2 tapes long. But no, the
tapes. What are
W's
those?
Yeah. 2 hours, simple 2 hours, and it's really engaging. And I think, and a lot of great performances. Toby Jones, as I mentioned, is Rove. Jeffrey Wright as Colin Powell. Thady Newton, Scott Glenn, and Richard Dreyfuss as Cheney.
Oh,
really?
Wow,
yeah.
Really?
So, you know,
that's an exciting pick.
Hooper from Jaws as Cheney. Interesting to come
Excellent.
Around. Interesting come around from chasing
Duddy
sharks
Kravitz
to being a shark.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's it for our movie special. I hope you guys enjoyed it. You can stay connected to us every day, all year long, at our website, opensourcesguelph.com. We are, of course, on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire, and you can follow us on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. And once again, Podbean is where you can go to download this episode or other episodes of the Guelph of the Open Sources show. I mean to say, it's on the Guelph Politicast channel. So you can listen to us anytime, wherever you listen to podcasts. I am at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter, and you can read my blog at guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
I'm Scotty Hertz on Twitter, also on Facebook, the Spanner Book. I posted a thing. It was a rerun, but it's there. So go check it out, spannerbook.wordpress.com. And yeah, it's there.
I think
it's
you meant to say it was a special edition because you added new things.
That's exactly what I meant to say. I don't know. I should have let you introduce it. I don't know. Yeah. Go read the thing.
Anyway, stay tuned next week for our New Year special, the best and the worst of the year, and our year-end wrap-up and all that good stuff. And that's on Thursday at 5 p.m., New Year's Eve, here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. Until then, have a Merry Christmas to each and every one of you, and you, our faithful listeners. Of course, Merry Christmas to you, Scotty.
And to you, Adam, and to everyone. Happy holidays, and whatever your holiday may be.
And we'll see you next week.